Well, we are going to begin today in 2 Samuel. We're completed 1 Samuel, and we're going to continue with the first chapter of 2 Samuel. Now, at the very end of 1 Samuel, what we had is we had the story of the death of Saul when they had the war with the Philistines, and Saul was killed, which was told to him by the prophetess, I guess you would say, that he brought in and said, Saul brought in, and Samuel came and said, "You are going to die," and sure enough, he did, and that was in 1 Samuel 31, and we see that Saul was hit with an arrow, wanted his armor bearer to kill him so he wouldn't be disgraced in front of the Philistines. His armor bearer said no, and so he fell on his own sword. And what we had is then the Philistines came and took his body and his son's body and cut the head off and fastened them to the outside of their gates so they could really humiliate Israel. And Israel went into mourning at the end of chapter 31. Well, David hadn't heard about this yet. So now we're going to see what happens in 2 Samuel when David hears of the events. And it started 3 days later that David heard about what went on. And what we read here to begin, and it says, "It came about after the death of Saul that David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag." Now, Ziklag is a town that was burnt, and that's where David lived. "And it came about on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And it came about when he came to David that he fell on his ground and prostrated himself. Then David said to him, 'From where do you come?' And he said to him, 'I have escaped from the camp of Israel.' And David said to him, 'How did things go?'" Probably he had a feeling they didn't go too well just from the looks of the guy. "Please tell me." And he said, "The people had fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." So David finds out about the final life or moments of Saul's life. "So David said to the young man who told him, 'How do you know?'" Now, I want to make sure this isn't hearsay. "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" The young man told him and said, "By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and he said, 'Here I am.' He said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' Then he said to me, 'Please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me because my life is still lingers in me.' So I stood beside him and killed him because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown which was on his head and the bracelet which was on his arm and have brought them here to my lord." So we have a combination of truth and error here, right? Saul died, right? Saul was injured in battle. But this guy didn't kill him, but he was close enough somehow to get his crown and his bracelet, which was on his arm, and he brought his crown and his bracelet and gave them to David. Now, no doubt this man was thinking he's going to get, you know, some reward. And he did get a reward, we'll find. Wasn't quite what he was expecting. But the man presented himself as a mourner and as a loyal subject to David. By presenting David with Saul's crown and armband, he expected this reward. "Wow, thank you very much. Look what you brought to me." But he was lying about the events. And the death of Saul and Jonathan and Jonathan's brothers opened a path for David to the throne. But it's not a joyous occasion for David. And we're going to find that David's path to the throne, he didn't just rise up to the throne and was king the next day. It took quite a while, and there's going to be quite a few events before he gets to that level. But it was not a joyous occasion for David. It was just the opposite. David mourned. He tore his clothes in verse 10 and 11. Said, then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and also did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. You know, Proverbs 24:17 says, do not rejoice when your enemy falls. Do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles. I don't know about you, but that's hard.
Yes, it is.
That's hard. Boy, there's some guys I just want to fail. Mm-hmm. Right? And boy, shame on me. I need to pray for forgiveness for that and to change that whole attitude. Maybe you don't have that problem. I have a feeling we probably all are in that boat a little bit. But Paul mourned for Saul out of compassion, without malice, even after all the stuff that Saul had done to him, thrown a spear at him many times, gave him his daughter for a wife and then took her away and pursued him and tried to kill him over and over and over again. And then we see that after this mourning had passed, that David again spoke to the man who came from Saul's camp in verse 13. So he's coming back to this guy. It says, David said to the young man, where are you from? And he answered, I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite. Then David said to him, how is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? The guy is figuring out, uh-oh. Then David called one of the young men and said, go cut him down. And he struck him and he died. And David said to him, your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. David wasn't going to do that. That's God's business. And so he killed this man for killing Saul, even though he hadn't killed Saul. He just wanted credit for killing Saul. Then we read in verse 17 and 18. Then David chanted with his lament over Saul and Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasar. Now, what in the world is that? Okay? How many of you here have read that book? You can, kind of. It's a book that's part of the Apocrypha, the non-biblical writings. The problem we have with that book today is no one knows for sure how authentic it is, because it was rewritten years and years later. It's been reproduced and falsified many times, and that's pretty well known. But you can go and you can read it, the book of Jasar. It's written in good Hebrew, and it has to do with the era of Adam to the Judges. But it's one of those apocryphal books. It's not part of Scripture, but it's out there. Now, how close what we would see is written there to what that book of the Song of the Bow is, you know, it's going to be a little bit different. But there are a lot of apocryphal type writings that we have that we can gain some insight, but we cannot think of them as Scripture. But anyway, what we have here, what is really written, part of the Scripture, is this song of praise to Saul and Jonathan. And that goes through the end of chapter 1. It says, your beauty, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. On the mountains of Gilboa, let not dew or rain be on you, nor field of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty was defiled. The shield of Saul not anointed with oil, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, from the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How have the mighty fallen in the midst of battle? Jonathan is slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. So he ends up talking about how Jonathan stayed with him, even though his father wanted Jonathan to turn on David. So as you look at this, in verse 19, there's sorrow over the fall of the mighty. And then there's this depreciation of any exaltation of the enemies of God in the land of the Philistines in verse 20. Don't let them proclaim it. Don't let them talk about it and have praise over this. But let's minimize this. Let's make this as small as possible. There's celebration over Saul's valor and military renown. You know, David had more military renown, but remember the saying, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. Saul killed, still got 1,000. You know, it wasn't like he was totally worthless in that. He just forgot God and went off the deep end. There's an honoring for the devotion of Jonathan to his father in verse 23. And then there's a calling on the daughters of Israel who had once sung Saul's praises. If we went back, I think, a couple weeks ago and talked about how Saul was praised by Israel when he first became king. And so there's the calling them who had once sung Saul's praises to now weep over their fallen leader, even though he did some pretty despicable things. And then there's the memorialization of the love that he and Jonathan had for each other. And that is the song of the bow that David put that ends chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. And we're going to find as we go all the way through 2 Samuel now, at the end of 2 Samuel is the end of David's life. That's the very end. He talks about him a little bit in 1 Kings, but basically, you know, this is the story as we go here is David's life after Saul as he becomes king and all the stuff that happens there. And it takes lots of years, but we'll start getting into that next week. Okay? Now if you want to go to Psalm 10. I'm not sure we'll get all finished with Psalm 10 today. There's lots of good stuff in Psalm 10. And this is the thing I'm going to send in the email that I didn't send that you have printed copies of. To begin with, we don't know for certain who the author of Psalm 10 is. Many people think it's David. David wrote Psalm 9, and some commentators believe that Psalm 10 is just an extension of Psalm 9. But most think that it's a separate psalm, and I would fall into that category too, and that's the way the Hebrew Old Testament has it, is a separate psalm. If it is an extension of Psalm 9, then David is the author. If it's not, we don't know who the author is. It could be David, could be something else. Martin Luther wrote this about this psalm. There is not, in my judgment, a psalm which describes the mind, the manners, the works, the words, the feelings, and the fate of the ungodly with so much propriety, fullness, and light as this psalm. That's pretty good comment. And it begins with a question of how God is dealing with the wicked. Verse 1, it says, "Why, O Lord, do you stand far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" The question the person is asking is, How are you dealing with the wicked, God? How are you dealing with those who rebel against you? You know, a person doesn't have to be what society may deem wicked to be a person who is in rebelling against God and deserving punishment for their sin. This is one of the things that most non-Christians struggle with, and many Christians do as well, and that is, so-and-so is such a great person, so how is God just in condemning him to hell? And a lot of Christian, in quotes, teachers today don't want to go there. I heard a couple interviews this week of people who, blatant false teachers, but have huge, huge audiences, thousands and tens of thousands in their churches, and someone will ask the question, well, do you think God is justified in sending someone to hell? And just about all of them answer the question the same way. And it's a total cop-out. Well, that's for God to judge. Well, God said it in his word, what he's going to do. But they will not say that. Well, that's for God to figure out. I don't want to do that. Okay? They don't answer the question. And the person was asking the question, honestly, was asking the question, say, okay, you've not answered the question now. Please answer the question. What do you think? I didn't ask you to avoid it. But we have people who don't want to have anything to do with the evilness of man because we want to think that man is basically good. So we don't see the person as wicked. We don't see him as perfect, but we don't see him as wicked. But what the question is here is, why, God, do you stand far away and hide yourself in times of trouble? And then it goes, the arrogance of the wicked. And it talks about the wicked in the next several verses. You know, at times, it looks like the evil and the godlessness of the world, or in the world, is one. It can be disheartening if we look at the present conditions of the world, the circumstances that get to you. It seems like they're winning. From our vantage point, it can look like we're surrounded by a world that is rejecting God and will continue on that path forever. And every day or every week, it seems like it goes further down that path. We want a God to come now in righteous judgment, don't we? We have a hard time waiting a week or a month or a year. But God's not in a hurry like we are. Waiting tens of years or hundreds of years or thousands of years is not really waiting a long time for him. Think of how long the children of Israel wandered in the promised land. Let's just put ourselves, we came out of Egypt, right? And all of us over 20, which is most of us in here, we said, no, we don't want to go in the promised land. So God said, okay, you're going to wander here for 40 years. I just finished working for a company for 39 years. That's a long time. I was a lot younger when I started. Right? That's nothing. I mean, 40 years. They had to wait 40 years. Think about the Babylonian captivity that Israel was in. That was 70 years. It was thousands of years from the original promise of the Messiah in Genesis 3:15, given to Adam and Eve, until Jesus walked on the earth. You know, God has his timing and he's going to get it done when he gets it done. So I can relate to the Psalms here when he writes, why, O Lord, do you stand far away? And why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? But it's not a cry of unbelief. It's not a cry of unbelief. It's those who reject and rebel against God will be punished for their rebellion. And you read through the Psalms, you understand that he's not saying, why aren't you doing what you said you were going to do, Lord? It's just a cry of, what's going on? Now, help me here. And then the next verses show the confidence of those who rebel against God. Those people who are rebelling against God are a confident lot. Verse 2 through verse 11. It says, in arrogance the wicked hotly pursue the poor. I read through this whole thing and I can see so much of that in just about every facet of our world today. It doesn't matter where it is. And I'm sure, and it's not new, because this was in David's time as well. I mean, you could apply this to any time of history. In arrogance, the wicked hotly pursue the poor. Let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. For the wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the one greedy for gain curses and renounces the Lord. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts are, there is no God. His ways prosper at all times. Your judgments are on high, out of his sight. As for his foes, he puffs at them. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Through all generations, I shall not meet adversity. His mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the villages. In hiding places, he murders the innocent. His eyes stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like a lion in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws them into his net. The helpless are crushed, sink down, and fall by his might. He says in his heart, God is forgotten. He has hidden his face. He will not see it. That is quite a statement. And that tells the story of the world who has rejected and is rejecting God. But it starts out by showing that these people really think they have the power and the wherewithal to continue into the future as far out as they can imagine. I'm not going to be moved. I shall not meet adversity throughout all generations, in verse 6. I remember a quote from J.R. Simplot before he died. He had lots of money. And someone asked him how it was set up. This was, you know, he's 98 or something at the time. He says, I have set it up so all of my heirs will be financially secure easily for at least 250 years. Well, first of all, that's pretty arrogant. But second of all, what's he saying? I shall not be moved throughout all generations. I shall not meet adversity. He didn't say he was going to live, but I've got this all figured out, and they're going to be set. That's the mindset of the non-believing person. The wicked boast of their heart's desire, which is interesting to think about. They boast of their heart's desire. That's in verse 3. That's diametrically opposed to the desire of God, and they know it. Remember, this song gets to me all the time. Remember Frank Sinatra? Yeah, yeah. My Way. My Way. It was originally released in 1969. It became known as his theme song in his later life. It's been recorded by many other artists, including Elvis, Sid Vicious, I don't have any of his stuff, the group U2, and 20 other groups that have recorded this song. It's a perfect example of those who reject God boasting of that rejection and that they think that they have the upper hand. Isn't it? The song is about a person nearing the end of his life and is pleased and prideful about his efforts and thinks that he pretty much has it all together. Which, by the way, was all done by him without any assistance from God, who, you get the idea, was God wasn't believed in anyway. But it demonstrates the heart's desire of those who reject salvation. Do not play that song at my funeral. Okay?
Did you know that that's one of the most popular funeral songs today?
I did not know that.
Yes. It's played all more than practically
any other song. It's a horrid song. It's a doctrinal train wreck. But we see in this psalm many of the effects of pride. Come on back. There we go. There we go. Pride keeps people from seeking after God. Someone said, it's hard to pray with a stiff neck and an unbending knee. Pride is the main thing that keeps people from accepting the gospel. The one thing you have to lose when you become a Christian is pride. Remember Naaman in 2 Kings 5? Naaman had leprosy. He was the general of the army. He went to Elisha for healing. And Elisha said, go wash in the Jordan. You'll be good. He goes, that dirty, muddy piece of junk river, I don't want to do that. We got nice rivers here. What do you have to give up? Pride. Pride. There's a guy named Richard Hooker. He lived from 1554 to 1600. You think man has changed? Listen to this quote. He said this on pride. Pride is a vice which cleaveth so fast unto the hearts of men that if we were to strip ourselves of all faults one by one, we should undoubtedly find the very last and hardest to put off. We can get rid of all the other garbage. But pride is the hardest and the last one we will ever put off. And that was in the 1500s. Verse 2 quotes two different things from these people that are known for. It says, the arrogance of the wicked, that's pride. They let them be caught in the schemes that they have devised. Pride and tyranny. Because pride results in tyranny. Pride in the heart and pride is in the heart, and tyranny is the action that comes about from that pride. The prayer here is that those who do such things will be treated as they have treated others. Now, I do not have a great insight on exactly how the judgment of God will work. Don't know. We're not told that. But concerning those spoken of here, we know that the righteous God will deal with these people accordingly as they have lived. And their pride will be stripped. There won't be any pride in hell, I don't think. In verse 4, the wicked then say, there is no God. In the pride of his face, the wicked does not seek him. All his thoughts is there is no God. Now, I went back and looked. There was a poll taken in August 2007 of the religious affiliation of those in the United States. At that point in time, 16% of all adults were agnostic or atheistic. They had no religion. In 2016, that same poll was taken, a similar poll, that number was up to 23%. Okay, that's 1/4 of all adults. Now, that doesn't include the people who would say, well, I'm a Christian or I'm a Catholic or I'm a this or that, but practically live that same life, because there's a lot of that as well. But people are turning away from God. They are being like it says right here, there is no God. And the psalmist says here, that's in the face of the wicked. So if you want to say there is no God and someone says, well, you're generally a pretty nice guy, I say, no, you're wicked. I think we have biblical precedent there. A guy named P.C. Craigie said it this way. He calls them functional atheists. Okay, the functional atheists are not concerned so much with the theoretical question as to the existence of God. Rather, he believes and behaves as if God does not exist. So it's one thing not to believe it, but it's another thing not to even behave or act like it. And that's what we have in our world today that's growing and growing and growing. From 2007 to 2016, easily it's grown by 7%. And who knows how much more than that. And it's going that direction, it seems like, all the more. And then on this same psalm, this Craigie said, in speaking of how these verses show God's dealings with those who reject him, there is not, in my judgment, a psalm which describes the mind, the manners, the works, the words, the feelings, and the fate of the ungodly with so much propriety, fullness, and light as this psalm. This psalm speaks to those people. And the psalm lists five characteristics of those who are wicked, practical atheists who have rejected God. The first thing in verse 2 to 4, we see that they are arrogant. The second thing they deal with is their prosperity. They talk about how prosperous they are. Then they talk about security in verse 6. They show vile speech in verse 7. And then they're prone to violence in verse 8 to 11. The first thing we see is arrogance. The words used in these verses are boasting, haughtiness, and pride. Haughtiness isn't what you would call an attribute you want to have. Right? Well, George over there, hopefully it's not George in here. George over there, he's pretty haughty. That's not, wow, man, I want to be like that. No, you don't want to be like that. Think of the arrogance it takes to belittle God, but people do it. In Isaiah, we have the story of the potter who builds this idol and then worships it and thinks that he's created this idol. But the word here, this pride shows a contempt for God and other men as well, and it comes out in actions and deeds. It says, these people crush the lowly. In verse 6, they say, I will not be moved. In verse 11, they say, God has forgotten. He has hidden his face, and he will never see it. Spurgeon said this, pride meets covetousness and compliments it as wise, thrifty, and prudent. These people think that they are special. A guy named Lewis Stuckey wrote many, many years ago. It says, when will men cease to be wiser than God? This is an insightful question in my mind. It has not been just in today's world that man has thought himself to be wise. The problem has been around for a long, long, long time. Since the garden. Or after the fall of the garden. In James 4:6, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. But what we have here is the wicked are proud. And then we see their prosperity. At least in this life, there are many who spurn God that are prosperous. They are not interested in the things of God, which are the furthest things from their mind. In some regard, they're their own idol. Go back to J.R. Simpla. He was prosperous from a financial standpoint. And there's tons and tons and tons of those examples.
But he died, didn't he?
Yeah. He died and all of his stuff is gone.
So he found out at the end that he wasn't God.
Yeah. There's a song out that says, I've never seen... let's see, I've never seen a U-Haul pulled behind a hearse. It's kind of a cute little song, but anyway, I hadn't thought about that for a long time. Now, if you ask me to, think about a verse that I memorized 4 weeks ago, I forget it, but that one I'll remember. I always remember the stuff I don't want to remember, but. Yeah, we don't take that stuff with us. In some regard, this guy is his own idol. He honors and worships himself. He thinks what he has accomplished through his work and through his intellect and through his desire. Of course, every time you feed those things, that just increases his pride and his arrogance and his desire. But that's what we see through this whole thing. The wicked boasts of the desires of his soul, and the greedy one gains, curses, and renounces the Lord. Wow. And then we see in verse 6, they believe that they are secure in their approach to life. He says in his heart, I shall not be moved. Throughout all generations, I shall not meet adversity. I will not be moved, and I will not meet adversity. They think that the success they are enjoying now will continue forever. Yes?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the pharaohs, the pyramids. Look at this. Look what I've done. Go down sometime to the cemetery there, Morse Hill, and go to some of the older stuff where these guys have these big mausoleums and these huge things.
Simplot has one there. It's huge.
Yeah.
And you can't help but notice it. I think it's bigger than anything there.
Probably. But, boy, they think that their life will last forever. But it won't. And it doesn't. And the next thing we see in verse 7, his mouth is filled with cursing and deceit and oppression under his tongue are mischief and iniquity. You know, what comes out of the mouth represents what's inside the heart. And what we see here, his mouth is full of cursing. It's not an occasional curse. It is normal. Now, I've known people like that. Somehow in the business world, some people think the more you curse, the stronger you are. And I've been around guys and they can't say a sentence without it. Right? It's just disgusting. But that's their attitude. That's that attitude. They don't think, well, first of all, they don't think that God's going to hear. He will never see it. Well, you're wrong. But it shows the arrogance that's inside. Yes?
My mom used to say that's the futile attempt of a feeble mind to be forceful.
A futile attempt of a feeble mind to be forceful. That's probably true. I always think it's an attempt of a guy who has a real small vocabulary. But the evil thing is not just something that's physically done to others. It's also done through voice and through words and through evil thoughts. Words and thoughts are important. And man is no different today than he was at the time Psalms was written. I don't know what the cursing was that they did back then, but they had it. Right? Man cursed then, just like he curses now. And we know what God thinks of it. And then in verse 8 through 11, we have violence. He sits in ambush in the villages and hiding places and murders the innocent. He'll stealthily watch for the helpless. He lurks in ambush like an iron in his thicket. He lurks that he may seize the poor. He seizes the poor when he draws him into his net. So who's he picking on? The poor, the downtrodden, the people that don't have strength. That's just like today. That's just like today. I have too many examples of being in the business world for 39 years. I've seen many times when the poor are taken advantage of so the rich can get richer. We could talk about that for a long time, but it happens all the time today, just like it did then. Man hasn't changed. His heart is still the same. His heart is still the same. But each of these activities are the physical manifestations of those who are arrogant and believe they are totally secure in what they wish to do. And we see in these verses, they are able to accomplish what they want to accomplish, what they desire. They are effective at doing this, for a short time anyway, because he is successful. This practical atheism that he is living seems to be the best way to proceed. He is not concerned about God or any punishment. In verse 11, God has forgotten, he has hidden his face, and he will never see it. Now, if you look at the actions and activities of well-known people in history who would be classified as wicked, these characteristics describe their mindset. And not only this, the horribly wicked, but a whole lot of other people as well. The actions people do are a result of their beliefs. And victims of their behavior are everywhere. They're caught up in their schemes and crushed by their power and their lack of compassion. Look at the devastation in the Sudan today. Just go to that one country. You will see how the weak are crushed with no apparent consciousness, that they're the conscious by the people doing it. And we need to remember that it's not just the weak who are the victims of the evildoers, because David was a strong leader, and he was victimized by them. Jesus was a strong leader, but he was victimized by them. He was anything but weak. But the practices of these people will be somewhat effective, and we need to be aware that the only reason it is effective is because of the tolerance of God. They boast that God will do nothing, but they are not looking at the longer term plan of God. God will do something, and God will be just, and this will be judged. And what we see today is not only the rejection of God, but in many cases, openly mocking God. And a lot of times in our society today, anyway, we have this whole LGBTQ. There's two other letters that go on it now, too. I think an S and a T, but I can't remember what they stand for. But they are, you know, this whole group has always been not following God's commands, but now they're openly celebrating their mocking of God. That's changed. They're openly celebrating this mocking. Who in the media today is ridiculed more? The Christian who believes the Bible is the Word of God and you should stand for right and wrong on that authority? Or the Muslim who believes that the Jews and Christians should be killed? Who does the media mock more? The Christian. Does the Christian get mocked because he says, no, abortion is wrong, it's murder? Or the person says, well, I have a right to my body. They always make fun of the Christian. It's going to happen. They're never going to say, oh, you're right, we need to change. No, because they want to live this lifestyle that we have here. And we see at the end of the psalm, the response of God, the response of God's people beginning in verse 12. It doesn't end there, because that's kind of a, wow, they're getting away with murder. Verse 12. I'll just read this and then we'll finish talking about it next week because we're running out of time, but I don't want to end on. It says, arise, O God, and lift up your head. Forget not the afflicted. Why does the wicked renounce God and say in his heart, you will not call into account? But you do see, for you note mischief and vexation, that you may take it into your hands. To you the helpless commits himself. You have been the helper of the fatherless. Break the arm of the wicked and evildoer. Call his wicked to account till you find none. And then verse 16, the Lord is king forever and ever. The nations perish from his land. O Lord, you hear the desire of the afflicted. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear to do justice to the fatherless and the oppressed, so that no man who is of the earth may strike terror no more. God is going to come and clean all this up. So we're not just left with this. Why, O Lord, do you stand far away and hide yourself in times of trouble? You go all the way down. You will. The Lord is king forever. You do hear the desire of the wicked. You will strengthen their heart. You will incline your ear. That means you're going to hear. To do justice to the fatherless and to the oppressed. God is a God of justice. Now, why he lets man go as far as he's gone, I don't know. But his justice will prevail. And that's one thing about the coming kingdom of God. It's going to be totally just. That is comforting to me, to know that the total justice of God. No one will get something they don't deserve. Except the Christian, the believer, we get salvation that we don't deserve because of the blood of Christ. And that's pretty cool. Let's pray.